Welcome to the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Today's great conversation is with Deborah Adelaide. Deborah is an associate professor at the University of Technology Sydney, where she teaches creative writing. She's the author of novels such as The Hotel Albatross and The Household Guide to Dying, as well as nonfiction and a short story collection, A Letter to George Clooney. In today's great conversation, she'll be discussing her latest short story collection, Zebra. I'm Andrew Popel, and every week I broadcast Final Draft from the studios of 2SER in Sydney. Final Draft explores the best of Australia's books, writing, and literary culture, and each week we feature an Australian writer exploring their latest work. The Great Conversations podcast is a chance to hear more of these discussions and get into the books that you love. We're always looking to get the word out to more book lovers, so why not share the podcast with a friend and continue the discussion together? Just by hitting subscribe, they'll get a great new podcast every week, and you'll have a new friend to discuss books with. Deborah Adelaide's Zebra is a collection of 14 stories in a range of voices and exploring different themes, from the hilarity of an intricately catered Christmas lunch to the horror of a future Australia where the Northern Territory intervention is taken to a hideous conclusion. Zebra is also the titular story of the collection. It's a novella exploring the rule of a very different Prime Minister to the ones that we've known. Overseeing a period of calm and prosperity, she's unsure of herself privately, but undoubtedly a public success. The story focuses on her creation of a unique public garden for the lodge whilst attempting to manage the relationships around her. Oh, and she's also gifted a zebra. You're tuned into 2SER 107.3 and you're listening to Final Draft. My name is Andrew Popel and I'm joined in the studio by Deborah Adelaide. Deborah's an associate professor at the University of Technology Sydney, where she teaches creative writing. She's the author of novels such as The Hotel Albatross and The Household Guide to Dying, as well as non-fiction and a short story collection, A Letter to George Clooney. Now today, she's joining me to discuss her latest short story collection, Zebra. Deborah, welcome to the studio.
Hello, Andrew. Pleasure to be here.
It's about now that I would offer up a pithy synopsis that introduces the listener to the story. But of course, Zebra, it's a collection featuring 14 stories, all with much to discuss. So apart from noting that in Zebra you have succeeded in making me hope just a little about politics, I don't think I'm up to the task of taking this all in just a few sentences. In fact, instead, I'm drawn to making a parallel with listening to an album. Partly because I'm going through a phase of wanting to listen to whole albums, not just individual songs. And as I play each story off the other and listen to their unique voice, I'm also listening for sort of themes and does it all kind of come together. But what does the creation of a collection mean to you?
I haven't thought about it as an album, but it's a very apt comparison to make. The way a collection comes together is basically hit and miss. Desperation, improvisation, and sometimes dropping things that don't seem to work and putting them away for a long time, rediscovering them. And that was certainly the case with the title story of this collection, Zebra, which is in fact a novella, which I'd started writing a long time ago. And it never seemed to work, and I put it away, and it inflated. I put it away again and I cut it back, and then finally I seemed to make it work. So to me there's no real system in putting a collection of short fiction together. It's just a matter of deciding, do I have enough stories to turn into a book? Are the stories good enough to work? A couple of stories I've had published before, do they deserve a second airing? And is there some way of tying the whole book together that satisfies me? And that's the big problem with a short story collection is, to me, the structure. Okay. So it took me a while to work out a structure that I was happy with, because I don't do what other authors do or tend to do and have themed collections. So having disparate voices, very different subject matters, different points of view, is all a bit tricky to juggle. However, as a reader of that kind of short story collection, that satisfies me, whereas I tend to get a little bit bored with the collections that are all on the one theme.
Okay. So if this were an album and we were doing a music interview, I'd be asking you about the ways you've mined your life and personal experience to craft each song. But instead, I want to start off a little churlish and topical, because I noticed in several of the stories, particularly the two that we start off with, Dismembered and Welcome to Country, themes of sort of cleaning out and organising. Mm. And look, with the KonMari method sweeping the world and overcrowding op shops, it seemed like kind of a cleaning out of our personal detritus is reaching almost epidemic proportions. But what does a clear out offer you as a source, I guess maybe personally, but also for writing and for inspiration?
It's really interesting that you mention that, because I was totally unaware of that theme of clearing out, and because the Marie Kondo stuff has gone mad. I confess I've even done my sock drawer recently.
Oh, I have too.
But not much more than that.
It's weirdly satisfying to open it up, yeah. Isn't it?
For the first couple of days, it's just a thing of absolute beauty. And then you just think, oh, why am I bothering? Just throw them all in again. But for the moment, it's lovely. But someone pointed out to me that those two first stories initially, that they had these strong themes of cleaning out. And I actually wasn't aware of that when I was writing it so much as the other issues in the two stories. So the first story, Dismembering, is really about a woman trying to come to terms with her ex-marriage and the ex-husband, even though she's on the surface very happy and has repartnered and has lovely babies with the new husband and everything seems to be going fine, but there's this undercurrent of something quite bleak and desperate that she obviously hasn't coped with, and that's represented in her manic clearing out of all the stuff around the house that she thinks belongs to the ex-husband and he hasn't bothered to take. And that's a sort of quirky, comic, darkly comic story. The next story, Welcome to Country, was one of these stories I had actually had published previously in the collection that Rosie Scott and Anita Heiss edited called The Intervention. And it's this, again, it involves a bit of cleaning out, and it's narrated from the point of view of a man who, and it's slightly futuristic, it's set sometime into a somewhat dystopian Australia, where a man has heard people singing on a radio, and then that show is shut down and the radio station stopped. And he is at the same time trying to deal with the loss of his son. And we don't know what happened, whether that son just disappeared or died. But he's decided to clean the boy's room out, the room that he's kept since the son was a boy. And that includes getting rid of a guitar. So he takes all this stuff to the op shop, and then he comes back home and he listens to this radio show, and then decides that what he has to do is go back and take the guitar that he's thrown out. And he takes it, he goes on a flight and goes to a place called Country, which is an ironic play on the Welcome to Country that we're so familiar with. But it's my comment on the way Indigenous people are still treated in this country. And it sort of set in a future where Indigenous people are actually put into a huge kind of quarantine piece of land, which is called Country. So he gives a guitar to people who want musical instruments.
I wasn't aware of the history of that story, the fact that it had been previously published. So is that story now sort of 5-10 years old?
No, it's only about 4 or 5 years old.
4 or 5 years old. Yeah. It struck me as frighteningly fresh and new and relevant. Are you a little bit, looking back on that story, are you a little bit scared at the parallels we see across the world, where walls being built and children being put in cages is headline news?
It's terrifying. And, you know, just this morning when I read the paper, there's all this comment about our borders are not safe because it's now been agreed by Parliament that sick people on Manus and Nauru can be medevaced, so they can have their journey here expedited in order to have their illnesses treated. Now there's this talk that our borders are unsafe, which is just, it's kind of bizarre. and almost comic, but frightening at the same time. Where did this obsession with borders and fences come from? Where did this obsession with keeping people out or in come from? Why are we so anxious about protecting our tiny bit of space? What is it we feel we're going to lose if someone walks into our front yard?
And more importantly, why do people think it's still going to work that way? If we can actually put zebra aside for a minute, and I'll just ask you to solve all the country's problems.
Well, actually, zebra does interrogate this in terms of the fence dispute with the neighbour.
But I want to give it its own space, because you mentioned Welcome to Country has really dystopian elements to it. Is it simply that our politicians are not reading? Because this is not new territory. Dystopias have been there to inform us for you know, our lives longer. Why are these books, these stories, not being read by politicians who can see, no, it never works out in the end?
Well, George Brandis had lots of bookshelves, so presumably someone down there in Canberra is reading. I don't know. Years ago, I toyed with the idea of sending a book a month to the Prime Minister, the then Prime Minister. This was inspired by the Canadian author Jan Martel, who religiously sent a book a month to the then Canadian Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, just to try and break through that impenetrable conservative anti-arts, anti-culture barrier. But I didn't go ahead and do it. I think if we got these politicians on their own, they would turn out to be or resemble reasonable people who possibly...
Or at least people.
Or at least people who do read books and go to the movies and think about and talk about the things that you and I are talking about right now. But as a pack, the obsession with power is so, to me, is so overwhelmingly prevalent that it smothers everything else. And all we see as ordinary Australians, as voters, all we see are politicians trying to protect their political power at all cost. You know, I've heard, for example, Labor politicians deplore the fact that we're keeping people in indefinite detention on Nauru and Manus Island. But publicly, they have to toe the party line.
And they have to hide personal sentiment behind platitudes like border security.
Yeah, and they're lies. I mean what the Prime Minister said in the wake of that parliamentary decision, and with all respect, was a lie. He now said our national security is under threat, which is just a complete and utter lie.
We do have other options for prime ministers, but I'm going to keep teasing this amazing novella, Zebra, because I also noted food featuring prominently, particularly, I'm going to call on festive food for the whole family and nourishment. So I saw parallels there with your consideration of the stuff in our lives, the things that we have to sort through, maybe get rid of, and the ways that we relate to it. You satire brilliantly the myriad food preferences in this really bizarre family Christmas. I pulled a quote out because I liked it. This is the preparer of the meal. Finding a healthy alternative to roast vegetables, seeing as so many of the guests are cutting down on carbs. Love it, love it. And then you also invert this as this care that's taken over a meal in nourishment is purely symbolic, ultimately, when the intended person can't eat. Do you feel like we still value the ways that we can come together over food?
Oh, I think we more than value. I think we revere it. We've turned it into a new religion.
But in doing that, do we then value it? Or is it like so many religious observations that we just go about?
Oh, look, if I were a philosophical kind of person, and perhaps if I was a bit more interested anthropologically speaking, I might say that people have, you know, people need to believe in something and they need to commit to something, and believing in and committing to food and meals is people have turned to that perhaps because they've turned their backs on other forms of commitment. For example, there's not much political action at the grassroots level in Australia. But there's a lot of action when it comes to food. You know, turn the TV on, every second show is a... I mean, there's a whole food channel I'm aware of. I might watch it occasionally. You know, there are weird shows like MasterChef, which I feel are actually dangerous and cruel. I mean, they torture people. They put people into situations and then create dramas that have to be perpetuated, which I think is just psychologically cruel. So it's not really about cooking.
That's what authors are supposed to do to fictional characters, not for real people.
Yeah. So I think I might have lost the thread of what I'm saying here, Andrew. But there is this massive food culture that then has to turn in on itself, because there's only so far you can go with food. Mm. You know, you buy produce, you take it home, you cook it, you eat it, it's gone. There's no real... There's no deeper meaning to it than that. But at its best, it's a perfect way to come together with your family, with friends and whatnot. But I think it doesn't really go that far. So people have created these fads. They've created these mad movements. It's years and years and years ago since we started to see the beginning of molecular gastronomy. But that's crazy when you think about it. You know, it's a long way from cooking. And every new restaurant in Sydney seems to have to do something cleverer, mm-hmm. wittier, more extreme. Find the least known bush food to incorporate into their meal, you know. So I just have fun with all of that, and I have fun with the food fads and the idea that some people seem to take to an extreme that they can't eat this and they can't eat that.
So in Festive Food for the Whole Family, have you perhaps almost created a parliament around the table where we're split into major parties and then you've got all these independents and somehow you have to come to at least a majority vote for the meal to be even successful?
I love this parliamentary metaphor you're pursuing here. I hadn't thought about that.
We're coming to a prime minister, so we've got to run with it.
I was actually... The reason I wrote that story was because I'd literally heard on the radio, approaching one Christmas, the radio program was about, you know, the hardest Christmas dinner you've cooked, or, you know, what's your challenge, what are you facing? And people were ringing in literally saying, well, you know, I've got a vegan... I've got a raw food, I've got a person who can't eat seafood, I've got two celiacs, I've got, you know, this. And I just thought, you know, it can't be too hard to satirise that in a story.
So you made it look easy. And I love a story with a story with a clear lesson, a clear message, which is don't kiss the cook's sister. It's dangerous for everyone.
Especially when the cook is your wife.
So now we come to your title track, if I'm running with the album conceit. Maybe we'd call this the first single. So Zebra is a novella that closes the collection, and it features a very different prime minister to the ones that we've known. She's unsure of herself privately, but undoubtedly a public success. And we focus in on her sort of shepherding the creation of this unique and public garden for the Lodge, a name she hates, as she attempts to manage the relationships around her, and she's also been given a zebra as a gift. I couldn't help but think of Julia Gillard and the treatment that she received from male media and pollies, and probably also a section of the female media as well, just because she was a woman.
Yeah.
There are some particularly confronting scenes in Zebra, particularly with the neighbour from Hell. But was this ever part of your thinking in writing? You've mentioned this is a story that was older and you've come back to.
Yeah. The mention of Julia Gillard is perfectly understandable. But in fact, I wrote this long before she became Prime Minister. And the reason I began writing the novel in its earlier incarnation, which became much longer, was because I was just so angry with the Howard government. I was so angry with what he was doing, closing down everything that I felt was valuable in life. And the thing that angered me more than anything about the Howard approach was his relentless story about we were an economy. And that's all he ever talked about, the economy. And he shut down the idea that we were much more than an economy, that we were a culture, that we had a spiritual side, that we had a artistic side, that we had community. It was always the economy. And that hardline approach, I just felt, was so crushing and narrow. And there were lots and lots of other things he did, of course, that drove me insane. But it was this one thing that just really got at me, and I thought...
Philosophically, he reduced us.
He did reduce us. He reduced... He might have improved the economy, but in every other way, he reduced us. And then the intervention, of course, was one example of that, and the Tampa crisis was another example. There's some very shameful things that happened under the Howard government, but under the radar of this overarching story was we've got a really strong economy. So writing any fiction from a position of bitterness and rage is very risky, because you end up having all those emotions flooding what you write, and that's not good for the reader. So I knew I had to process all of this if I was going to deal with it. So I just thought the best way to do this is to imagine someone who is everything Howard is not. A woman, for a start. Mm-hmm. Someone with no personal ambition, but just wants to do a really good job running the country. A modest person, and a person who's interested in gardening, culture, not interested in the economy, but good at it. And at the same time, the country was gripped by drought. So in the original version of this novel, the drought lifted and she was somehow responsible for that. And she was just a prime minister who was everything that hadn't been, that we hadn't seen in public life. And then circumstances changed, and everything actually changed in Canberra, and it was, as you remember, quite volatile for a while. And yes, we had a female prime minister who isn't my female prime minister, but she certainly was female, and conspicuously so. And other things changed. The drought actually broke, if you remember, and we had a lot of serious rainfall for a few years. So I just thought, well, there's no point, you know. Life has intervened and things are going to be better. But of course, things are never better in politics. They shift a bit this way and a bit that way, but they never really change.
And they have to, well, it seems now they're constantly manufacturing the worst thing to position themselves against so they can fix it. So we constantly want them in charge.
Yeah, and I often say lately, I feel sorry for comedians and satirists at the moment, because like, look at what happens in Canberra. They do the job for you if you're a comedian. It's just the toppling of Malcolm Turnbull is a perfect example of that. Like, we still don't know why Malcolm had to go. And Scott Morrison's wonderful bus story.
Oh, yeah.
Which is just like a John Clark Brian Dawe script. It's, if you've read the transcript of it, which I have, it could have been one of their more brilliant scripts. So, again, I think I've lost my thread, but what was I saying? Things really don't change much in politics, and it's very hard to take them seriously. It's politicking. It's not getting anything done, really. So I pulled the story out again and thought, well, I'll give it another go. And by this stage, I'd stripped it back to a 30,000-word novella. So that's the story of Zebra.
And so we come to whether...
It's a fantasy.
it's a beautiful fantasy.
Good things happen.
So we come to whether this was intended in the collection or not. I saw in Zebra emblems or a pulling together of other ideas... Ideas around food and the importance of food and the way. There's a labyrinth, a maze that's created, that sort of inaugurates production of food that can be used. And there is a going through of effects that to sort of almost to decide what's important. And you mentioned there that you positioned your prime minister against John Howard, who reduced us and took away so many things, but you know, really sort of narrowed down the soul of who we are. And in the collection, I see this exploration of things that make us who we are. And it's not all the things that we have. That's why we need to sort through our effects and find the ones that are important to us and why we need to come together over food, but for the right reasons and you know, maybe relax about, you know, the exact makeup of the meal.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that there's much about food in Zebra, although at one point the Prime Minister does fantasise about selling produce from the garden in the lodge at the front gate.
But that was huge.
Until people say, oh no, that wouldn't be a very good idea in terms of security.
She wanted to create a whole sort of cottage industry around bay leaves.
And lily pillies.
And lily pillies, the jam. It was almost a point of bonding when I don't want to give too much away about the neighbour story, but I do want to. Ideas of stewardship kind of filled my thoughts as I watched your Prime Minister consider her choices. She weighed her values in leading the country. Now, this is a beautiful novella. It's about 120 pages, so there is so much story to get into, and I don't want to give away the ending, but I was drawn back to the ideas from stories like Welcome to Country, and I Am at Home Now. As I thought about this sort of role of leadership, and of course it's not stewardship that we see in our leaders at the moment, but something of a dictatorship by media scrum. But were you looking at this, you've already told me, this was something of an ideal and an antithesis to the Howard era, but if you can talk, you know, obtusely about the ending without giving too much away, this idea that we're stewarding. When we are in charge, we're only stewards.
I really like that word. I hadn't thought about that. But it is a matter of stewardship. And what my Prime Minister does is she gives up things as a way of giving back to the country because she feels that leadership is by example, by personal example and by professional example. So this story is, I mean, you mentioned Welcome to Country and I'm at Home Now. So this is my reconciliation story, I guess. And without giving away the ending, I guess I was thinking, what is ultimately the most symbolic act the Prime Minister could do to express a hand of reconciliation? And that's what that's all about.
I feel like I am speaking with Deborah Adelaide and we are discussing her collection, Zebra. This is where we have to turn off the mics. We're going to keep talking about this because I can't give away the ending to Zebra. I don't think it'd matter if I gave away the ending to Zebra because so much of the story is in... We haven't talked about the zebra. The zebra is fantastic and amazing and perhaps we can't do it justice because it weaves itself through the Prime Minister's life and through the story in... an amazing way. I don't have words.
Well, people who know me will say, oh, yes, zebras, because I've always loved zebra print.
I noticed a zebra print scarf in one of the stories, yes.
There is, and I do have one. I have lots of zebra patterned shoes, handbag, sandals, items around the house, little statuettes. Zebras have always appealed to me. Because they are so dignified but so preposterous and they carry that absurdity of their markings with great dignity and I love that. But also, of course, the zebra, it's not just in there because I happen to like zebra patterns. That would be self-indulgent to the extreme. The zebra is there because the zebra, being both black and white, represents... the issues that the story is exploring in terms of black and white relations, and also because of that joke, which is alluded to but not spelt out in the story. And if readers don't know that joke, they can always just go and Google it and find out the ending. So the zebra is emblematic of what's going to happen with Indigenous and non-Indigenous people coming together. But also the zebra in being given to the Prime Minister comes from out of the blue, totally unexpected. And it is ridiculously unlikely that a zebra would be housed in the lodge in Canberra. But it is. So the zebra is something for the Prime Minister to think about very carefully. It's something she has to look after. It's an animal she's got to provide for materially, but it also makes her think about her own political position and then act on it. And she literally follows a zebra's lead.
So that's the zebra in Deborah Adelaide's collection, Zebra. Thank you so much for coming into the studio, Deborah. It's been amazing to discuss this wonderful collection.
Thank you, Andrew. It's been a pleasure.
That's it for this great conversation with Deborah Adelaide. Deborah's latest collection is Zebra, and it's out now through Pan Macmillan. Great Conversations is recorded on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation at 2SER's Broadway Studios in Sydney, Australia. The show is produced and presented by Andrew Popel. Now, to keep up with the latest in books, writing and literary culture, follow us on Twitter, on Instagram and on Facebook. Just look for @FinalDraft2SER. And if you click subscribe in the podcast app, you will get a new Great Conversation every week, sometimes even a bonus episode when we've just got so much to share. My name is Andrew Popel. I will be back next week with more great conversations from Final Draft. Till then, happy reading.